iNew York. I'm Chris Bingert Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 28th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Capitol Hill by discussing the importance of leaked documents belonging to Texas Senator Ted Cruz and the hypocrisy of the quote-unquote drain the swamp mantra by elected officials. This month, reporter Pablo Manriquez found documents that show details of Texas Senator Ted Cruz's donor meetings. The documents discovered in the food kiosk on the first floor of the U.S. Capitol appeared to include information about a series of meetings between the Texas Republican and campaign donors. Now, while it is no surprise to the public that elected officials are doing this sort of wheeling and dealing in Washington, under federal campaign finance law, it doesn't necessarily make it any less illegal. In addition to the leaked documents itself, this story also brings up the issue of censorship, as Manriquez's posts on Twitter were deleted for containing personal phone numbers and addresses. So to recap, bribery, illegal donor meetings, hypocrisy, censorship, demagoguery, normalized corruption. So today on the show, not only are we going to address these issues today, but we'll do it with the very reporter who broke the story. So we have with us today Pablo Manriquez, who's a contributing editor for The New Republic. Welcome to the show, Pablo Manriquez.
Thank you, Oscar. Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. And also with us on the show is our fan favorite, Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Texas. And together with Pablo, he's the co-author of the Capitol Press Substack. And together, they fight crime. Welcome to the show, Arturo Dominguez.
Thanks for having me, man. It's always fun. It's a blast to be on here.
Yeah, this should be interesting and fun today. Yep. Because, Pablo, it's been a while since we last spoke in person like this, but the last time we did, you told me something about reporting on Capitol Hill that immediately came to my mind when you broke this story, which is that, you know, sometimes all you have to do is wait for the story to come to you over on Capitol Hill. Well, in this case, the story was left next to the soda machine, apparently. So let's begin by breaking down what you found and why it is illegal to have this at the Capitol. I know you have a lot to say about New York, but I want to put that aside for a moment and let's deal with the immediate. What did you find and why is it illegal to have it on the Capitol?
The first thing I want to say is I didn't break this story alone. Arturo and I have a newsletter called Capitol.press where these documents live that I found in the Senate refectory. Arturo is the publisher of Capitol.press. I found them because I wanted to the Capitol all day, but I couldn't have put them up online without Arturo. So, you know, we've been doing this together. We are in it to win it. And this is a Latino-owned, Latino-operated operation. So when I walked in there, I knew that I had our people, right, to represent. When I find this folder sitting in the Senate refectory, as you say, first floor, food kiosk, right? And I'm thinking to myself, yo, free folder. I'm going to grab that. But then I opened it up and it was even bigger. It was more than a free folder. It was full of solid gold from a reporter perspective, right? This was Ted Cruz's briefing documents for 7 donor meetings. Inside this folder were 16 pages stapled into 7 different packets, each one representing one meeting, right? A meeting in Washington and 6 meetings in New York, right? So I go upstairs knowing what I had. Juneteenth is the next day. My editors at the New Republic, my editors at Vanity Fair, my editors at these other outlets where I write, they're about to go on vacation. I'm not about to make their, you know, night go even longer, right? So I'm like, you know what? What I'm going to do is I'm going to take these one at a time. I'm going to put them on the floor. I'm going to take a picture of them with my phone and I'm going to post them on the internet. So I posted them on Twitter. Well, now X, right? And they were up for about 4 hours. And when I posted them, just so you know, I wasn't trying to hide these from anybody. I tagged the people that were mentioned in the document. So if Ted Cruz was meeting with Mike Novogursk or Len Blavatnik's handler, I tagged Len Blavatnik and I tagged Mike Novogursk and I tagged all these people. And I said, hey, so tomorrow Ted Cruz is going to meet with this guy and that guy. So 7 tweets, right? And then at the end of it, like any entrepreneurial journalist, any entrepreneurial reporter on the internet today, I said, be sure to sign up for my newsletter, right? And so 4 hours later, Twitter takes all of these tweets down, except for the first one that says, hey, I found these documents, and the last one that says, be sure to subscribe to my newsletter, right? So when these things disappeared off the internet, I was just all like, you know what? I'm going to go to bed and let the internet take care of it, right? Because, I mean, you know, 4 million people had seen these documents by the time they removed them from the internet. It wasn't like the internet was giving these documents back. The cat was out of the bag. There's no getting him back in. So when I wake up the next day, turns out I was right. The internet had taken care of it. The whole internet was just sort of like, oh my God, where can I get these documents? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm all like, word, you know? So we post them on Substack on our newsletter, capitol.press, right? And they live there to this day. I also posted them on Reddit or Congress, our community that we run on Congress on Reddit. It's the biggest Congress-focused community on Reddit or Congress. And people just found them there, right? Like, you know, now, why were they removed from X? Well, because the documents included the personal addresses and business addresses and the cell phone numbers of a lot of people. And X has an explicit prohibition of publishing addresses and phone numbers of individuals. So I totally broke the rule. I should not have broken the rule. I hadn't really thought of it when I posted them. I was just kind of excited because I knew that like I was posting these documents and I knew that Ted Cruz was about to have his first donor meeting like 2 hours after I posted the document.
That's right.
Which is why I made the decision to post them. I was just like, you know what? If I post them after he's already asked for money from all these people, if I post them after he already got the commitment for all these people to pay him, what good is that for people in Texas like Arturo who are like, who are all these non-Texans giving my junior senator all this money, right? So I posted them. They took them down. I got this call from X. They're like, yo, you know, we're not trying to censor the press or whatever. You just can't post them there. You can't post them with the addresses and the phone numbers. And I was all like, yeah, you know, that makes sense. If I repost them, will you not take them down? They're like, yeah, no problem. Just, you know, redact the phone numbers and the addresses. I was like, well, I can leave the names. I can leave the amounts. I can leave all that other stuff. They're like, yeah, no problem. Just the phone numbers and addresses. So from now on, I took a tube of paint up to the Capitol so that whenever I find the next time somebody But next time some idiot leaves their sensitive documents in some public place in my Senate or House, right? I will go up to my desk. I will paint out the numbers, the phone numbers and the addresses, and I will post them on the internet again, because you are not supposed to be fundraising in my Capitol. That is illegal and completely inappropriate, especially if you're the junior senator from Texas asking for seven figures of donations from people who have nothing to do with Texas whatsoever.
Idiot is an understatement. I have to say that, considering, as I said before at the beginning, you know, federal campaign finance law that was broken here. Now, we'll get to the issue of New York in a second, I promise you. But Arturo, when you saw these documents, since you and me are sort of on the outside looking in, when you saw these documents, what did you think? Did you see this in the same way as Pablo, like, oh, we just found a pot of gold here?
You know, yeah, actually I did. My initial reaction was, you know, figures he's not doing anything for Texas, right? He's New York and D.C. and he's meeting with all these people and all this money. And, you know, he never does anything for the state. I don't know that he's ever accomplished anything for the state. So it wasn't that big of a surprise, but it was like, oh, wow, like I get to see, you know. And I think that was the deal, like on Reddit and stuff, people were like, who are these people and who's he meeting with here? And how much money is he asking for there? And you know how Reddit could be, it could get a little crazy. But yeah, you know, I looked up a few articles that picked up on Pablo's tweets. And, you know, one of them focused more on the legalities of it and like how he's just, Ted Cruz is just riding that fine line. Like he's teetering on violating, you know, campaign finance law. I wasn't aware of this whole thing, you know, that Pablo just brought up. I didn't even think about it being illegal to have that up at the Capitol. So yeah, that's another issue in itself too. But yeah, it's the way they manipulate the numbers in there, you know, after reading up on some of this campaign finance stuff, it's pretty slick. I got to give it to them. It's pretty slick. You know, like the big $100-something thousand donation, you know, if you divide it up to like the four PACs and then donations like for the donors' wives and stuff, that comes out to that exact dollar amount. And like somebody did the math, I think it might have been Wall Street Journal, and like it came out to the dollar, like right on that limit. And it was just, it's so crazy to me because you're sitting here watching him and you know this all has to do with favors later, because all Ted Cruz cares about is getting back in that office. That's all he cares about. It's like Trump. It's all about Ted Cruz all the time.
Absolutely. And we've mentioned this, you and me, numerous times here on the show as well, of all sorts of things with relation to Ted Cruz, whether it's support of police in the state of Texas to Uvalde and everything else in between. It's one of those how the sausage is made type of moments here in these leaked documents. So, Pablo, I saw you last week in an interview on Roland Martin's show, which is a great show, by the way. And you mentioned that the meetings that Cruz had in New York were perhaps more interesting than the ones in Washington. Now, you already mentioned that this is illegal under campaign finance law to do this on the Capitol in Washington. So can you elaborate on the difference between that which took place in Washington and these meetings in New York? Because you just mentioned a second ago, one of these donors, Blavatnik, Len Blavatnik and Mike Novogratz. I'm going to mess up these names here. I bring those two names up on your Substack article because those two in particular also donated to Biden's Victory Fund in 2020. So these are sort of the campaign donors who are like, I guess for lack of a better term, hedging their bets with regards to elections, but they are Republican donors at the end as well, especially with this information that came out.
Yeah, so the thing is, every lawmaker in the Capitol wears two hats, right? The hat of someone campaigning for office and the hat of someone who is a lawmaker, right? Then they are not supposed to be raising money. They're supposed to go across the street to like the DNC or the RNC or go sit out in their car or something like that and make their donor calls. You know, I mean, like most lawmakers have to like prostitute themselves out for a few hours a day calling people for money, right? So what we have with the Ted Cruz briefing documents in New York isn't necessarily illegal. First of all, it's not illegal to receive a briefing document. And it's not illegal to go to New York and ask for, you know, apparently it's not illegal to even ask for these insane amounts of money if you divide it up across, you know, leadership packs and stuff like that, right? But what is illegal to do it in the Capitol? Because when you're in the Capitol, you are supposed to be making laws. Like, you know what I mean? You're supposed to be representing Texas. So these documents, the reason why I think they were so damning is twofold, right? Are they a smoking gun, like dead to rights illegality? Not necessarily. But what makes them really funky is they were in a United States Senate folder, which is one thing. That's like, you know, they weren't on a cruise for Texas folder. They were in the United States Senate folder. And two, they were in the Capitol where Ted Cruz is supposed to be pushing laws. He's supposed to be voting on laws. He's supposed to be meeting with other lawmakers from other states to create legislation, right? So when he leaves the building and he goes down to the Capitol Grill where he likes to raise money, right? Where he likes to have dinners where his donors come and that, you know, they sit around and he asks for money. That is par for the course in Congress, unfortunately, right? But not in the Capitol. So as someone who has a very hermetical view of their beat, I cover the Capitol and then I come home in oil paint. That's it, right? I don't go to Texas to find out what Ted Cruz had for breakfast this morning. I don't care. When he comes to my Capitol, then I'm activated as a reporter, right? When they're on recess, I'm an oil painter. You know what I mean? So it's a pretty simple thing. I don't leave. I don't go other places. I just cover the Capitol. And in the Capitol, fundraising is completely inappropriate, if not illegal. So if Ted Cruz is sitting at his desk with his Capitol issue phone, or his staffer is making calendar invites with their Capitol issue phone with their .gov email address for appointments with donors, that is literally illegal, right? They are not hired. The people of Texas, the American taxpayer, doesn't hire these staffers, and Ted Cruz hasn't been elected to raise money. He's been elected to represent Texans. He's been elected to represent Lone Star State constituents, right? So when I found them in the refectory, I didn't think twice. If this had been a document of like what Ted Cruz's briefings are on the bills that he's going to meet on today, right? Like today, we're going to go meet with Mitch McConnell about this bill. We're going to go meet with, like, you know, Chuck Schumer on this bill. Then we're going to go to a caucus luncheon and talk about like Ukraine or Israel or whatever. I don't think I probably would have tweeted them unredacted. I probably would have tweeted them, but I don't think I would have been that like careless and nonchalant about putting them out there. Because he would have, these just would have been the regular day-to-day documents of him doing his job. But because they were fundraising documents in my Capitol, our Capitol, right? This isn't Ted Cruz's Capitol. It's our Capitol. It's ours and Ted Cruz's Capitol. It's Texas's Capitol. It's Maryland, Virginia, Missouri's Capitol, right? So it got me. And I knew that the internet was going to need these. And that I also knew that I was very much protected because the place where these idiots left them has security cameras. There are very few eateries in the Capitol that have security cameras. Most things that go on in the Capitol, right, happen unsurveilled, right? And the hallways are surveilled. We know from the January 6th footage and stuff like that of people running around, Josh Hawley, whatever. But if you think about that footage of Josh Hawley running across the screen, right, it's not like you can see his face. It's not like you can see like the two Capitol policemen, one that has back to us, one that has the front, right? It's not like this is surveilled like an Apple store. This is surveillance from the 70s because they don't actually want to know what's going on. They don't want to know who's meeting with who. They don't want to know who's walking the hallways with who, right? But for whatever reason, the Senate refectory has three cameras. So whoever left that document there, whoever left that folder there is very much on camera, right? Very much on camera doing it. So it was not plausibly deniable. If I had found him in the bathroom or something like that, they could have been like, this reporter made it up. We're not going to Texas. We're, you know, they just cancel all their donor meetings. And they say, oh, we're not going to New York tomorrow. We're going back to Texas to go campaign at the state fair or whatever. But like, no, you can't do that because I didn't find him in the bathroom. I found him in the refectory, and the refectory just happens to be a place where I'm protected because I know I picked them up on camera.
And it said U.S. Senate on the folder. So it may as well have said like top secret or confidential on the folder.
Well, it might as well have said, this is a folder full of policy documents that Ted Cruz is using that could represent the state of Texas. If it had been a Ted Cruz for Texas folder, then I would have assumed, yeah, these are fundraising documents or these are campaign documents. But these were fundraising documents, campaign documents, and a Senate folder. So his capacities were mixed in this moment.
Yes.
And the mixing of the capacities, while potentially not illegal, I think he could get away with it if he really wanted to, it's funky. And I knew that the internet was going to respond to it in a way that, like, again, I found it funky. The internet found it funky. No one in this whole ordeal has reprimanded me at all in the least.
And they shouldn't.
For finding them and posting them, including Ted Cruz himself. No one has said Pablo was in the wrong here, except X. And in their case, they're right. I was in the wrong for posting their addresses. And when I posted them back up, they didn't take them down. So, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories going on around Elon Musk is friends with Ted Cruz and trying to censor Pablo. No, Pablo just skipped a step, and next time he won't, right?
Well, it's good that you mentioned that, because we'll hit on X later. I usually say Twitter, I don't say X. But before we continue, I want to reiterate something that you mentioned in passing that I think is very important, and we should make very clear to the audience that no one here in this conversation is naive to believe that this sort of wheeling and dealing is exclusive to Ted Cruz or exclusive to the Republican Party. Both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, are doing this. It's just that we have evidence of one senator doing this, but it's not exclusive to that one senator or to that one party as well. And so not only that, but this sort of wheeling and dealing is not exclusive to the Capitol and Texas alone. So for example, Arturo, the day after Pablo broke the internet, the Texas Tribune reported that Cruz's ironically named Truth and Courage PAC received $1 million donation from Miriam Adelson, the billionaire casino tycoon and owner of the Dallas Mavericks. Miriam Adelson is also the widow of the late Sheldon Adelson, who donated to Trump, to various Republican causes throughout the country. So what does this tell you about Cruz's reelection bid for later this year? I know that he's being challenged by Representative Colin Allred, which, to be honest with me, is kind of disappointing because I would have preferred to see him go against Roland Gutierrez, who's done some work, a lot of work actually, with regards to Uvalde and has challenged Cruz with regards to Uvalde. But again, this is not even exclusive to what took place in Washington, that this sort of wheeling and dealing is happening in Texas as well.
Yeah, you know, ever since Miriam Adelson bought the Dallas Mavericks, she's become more and more involved in Texas politics. And, you know, her husband, Sheldon Adelson, you know, he pro-Israel guy, you know, they fund a lot of pro-Israel. They're kind of pretty narrow focused, almost single issue, and that's Israel. Sheldon Adelson donated tons of money to like anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, Islamophobic groups through the years. And they call it the Islamophobia Network.
There's a lot
and that thing's worth like, I mean, between 2017 and 2019, they raised over $105 million for like anti-Arab and anti-Islam, you know, Islamophobic type of legislation, TV ads, like all this, the same stuff that they've been pounding in our faces since 9/11. And Islamophobia seems to have become such a normal thing. So in that sense, it's not really a surprise to see Miriam Adelson giving Ted Cruz $1 million. I mean, or his PAC $1 million. It is sort of new because, you know, she's getting more involved, but considering the interests and kind of what drives, you know, their beliefs and their monies and things like that, it's not really surprising. I don't know what this means for Allred, which I kind of had hopes for, and I'm with you. I think Gutierrez would have done better against Cruz than Allred, but that's where we are. And I thought Allred was doing better in the polls, but the latest one I seen, he was down like 11 points. So not real sure how this is going to end up. It looks like Ted Cruz might just roll in there, because I don't doubt he's going to start seeing all kinds of AIPAC money and things like that too. So there's a lot of money floating around for guys like Ted.
It's not just AIPAC either.
No.
And this is something else from the Texas Tribune that really got under my skin, and on top of everything that Pablo just mentioned, that his Truth and Courage PAC, again, oddly named PAC for somebody like Ted Cruz, also received $156,000 in quote-unquote digital revenue from iHeart Media Management Services, which just also happens to syndicate his podcast. Ted Cruz has a podcast. That's so annoying. And iHeart Media here in Washington has almost a semi-monopoly on the whole radio industry here in Washington. And that's just one major market. They do the same thing in several other major markets. And they are syndicating, as I just said, Ted Cruz's show to other parts of the country. And it's just an infuriating side note that the Texas Tribune noted, just to show you how much money he's getting and how little it has to do with the needs of the general public in Texas. Not to mention that all these New York meetings that Pablo mentioned also speaks to the hypocrisy of, I'm a man of the people, I'm here to drain the swamp. You know, these New York liberals, all this and that. But Pablo's documents, or should I say, Pablo's information that he presented on here shows that while he's saying one thing to the public, the other hand is doing something completely different along the way. So all sorts of things that came out of this leaked document story, and it's all possible because of Pablo Manriquez, who's a contributing editor for the New Republic, and Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Texas. Together, they are the co-author of the Capitol Press Substack. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more. Stay tuned. La Plebe, you're listening to Latino Media Collective on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us online at latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and in the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the controversy of Ted Cruz's leaked documents with Pablo Manriquez, who's a contributing editor for the New Republic, and Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Texas. So there's another side to this controversy that we've been discussing, and that's the issue of censorship on Twitter. And just to be clear, because Pablo already mentioned this already, it is not good, generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, to post people's addresses, phone numbers, email, and other private information. But what happened to the free speech absolutism promoted by Elon Musk as it pertains to Twitter, especially when it comes to exposing the mechanisms of institutional corruption? And I'm directing this question to you, Arturo, because you've been following, you know, hate groups and individuals for a number of years, and there have been hateful right-wing trolls on Twitter even before and especially during Elon Musk's ownership of Twitter that have done more egregious things than Pablo has done and have been punished or reprimanded even less so. And so this is a sort of an irony that it cannot escape me, considering, you know, what we've seen in Twitter since Elon Musk took it over.
It's an issue, right? Because for a free speech absolutist, right, it's almost like if you don't think like he does, your voice doesn't matter. So I think of some good examples when you were talking about what they take down and what they don't. You know, when I was covering the Take Our Border Back convoy, which they're still doing their thing because they're getting money through donor advised funds and stuff from people like the Adelsons and those types of people, they were posting stuff on there, and then other hate group members were chiming in, and they were pretty much expressing violence. Like, when they get there, there's going to be violence, you know, in Texas. And I laughed it off because you're coming into one of the most armed states in the union. I really doubt that's going to happen here. But people were DMing me telling me that, you know, they're reporting these tweets for, you know, inciting violence. And some of them were pretty blatant about it. And Twitter was responding with, they're not violating the rules. You see people posting the N-word, you know, because I'm in community with a lot of Black writers, particularly a lot of Black women writers, and they're big targets. And you see the N-word nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. And they're throwing it at Black women, and they're using all kinds of slurs, and none of that stuff gets taken down. So, you know, at least the block feature still works, but I don't know for how much longer at this rate. But then if you're critical of Israel, again, you know, I went from millions of views a month on my Twitter to like thousands ever since October 7th, because I've been posting and writing and talking about that stuff. And to me, you know, the view counts don't really matter, but it is worth noting. It's something to pay attention to. People are still reading my stuff, so I'm not really worried about like social media engagement as much. But you see it in your analytics. You know, you still look to see what does well, what articles do better than others, things like that. And there's a massive decline. And certain tweets are dead before I even hit the enter button, you know, before I hit send. So other people that are having these issues too, and they're trying to track it, and it's becoming more and more obvious that people like us, right? Like, the way we don't talk, we don't think, we don't act like an Elon Musk or like white people in general. So a lot of times, you know, we get pushed aside just because we talk a little different, we think a little different, we do things differently. Pablo and I have both been criticized for using certain terminology in an article. And it's like, we use that terminology because that's the terminology, say, Ted Cruz is using. So we use that terminology with Ted Cruz because that's going to get his attention, and that makes him answer the question. When Pablo was talking about asking about the cancellation of drag shows at the Smithsonian, he kept approaching a lot of lawmakers by saying, hey, I have a culture war question. And there was some criticism about that because it had to do with the LGBTQ community and Pablo calling it a culture war type thing. But that's what got their attention. And that's what it is. These politicians are creating culture wars over things that should just be normal, man. Like, people, just leave people alone, you know, let them be. And by approaching them in that way, it really got their attention. Some of them, nervous laughter. They're like, what? What did you just say? And he's like, yeah, culture war question. And they would listen and they would respond. And, you know, criticize what you want. Pablo got the answers no one else could get. He got them from people that wouldn't talk to them otherwise about the LGBTQ community, you know, particularly Republicans. Most of them are silent about it and they do their dirty work behind closed doors. And they don't normally talk to reporters about it. They make jokes. Lindsey Graham makes jokes about how hosting drag parties and things like that. But they're not answering the important question. And by doing it the way Pablo does, or by being somewhat crass like I am, it gets people's attention. You know, and are readers like that, or followers like that? Most reporters are like, oh, you know, you can't talk to them like that because then you won't have access. Want to bet?
There you go.
Want to bet?
There you go.
They need us. We don't need them.
Ding, ding, ding. You just brought up something very important, and that's access. Because, Pablo, a lesser reporter would have turned those documents back to Ted Cruz's office or somebody else as a means to maintain their access to whoever politician in question here. And so I bring this up to you now, Pablo, because one of the few places like Yahoo News did write an article on these leaked documents that we're discussing here. And they managed to speak to a GOP operative, of course, under the condition of anonymity. And they were quoted as saying, there's nothing out of the ordinary with the documents. This is a quote from Yahoo News. And another quote said that it's obviously embarrassing to have it out there because your donors trust you to be responsible with their information. Of course, not making any mention about voters, the people who voted for Cruz into office. So of all the articles that I've read with regards to the leaked documents, this one sort of hit me the wrong way, Pablo. I don't know if it hits you the wrong way as well, that there are certain people who feel like this is okay, this is normalized, because as you just mentioned, this is illegal under campaign finance law and should not be done under any circumstances on the Capitol. And this gives me the impression that reporters think, oh, well, this happens all the time, so therefore it's normalized.
There's a difference between saying it's something that happens all the time and that it's something that's acceptable. I do think that there are very few members of Congress that don't receive briefing documents on the donors that they're going to call, especially in the Senate, where senators have more staffers than House members, as you know, to tend to their business because they have larger constituencies than the House members. So I think that one of the things that the three of us in Latino Rebels created, right, was that we're rebels. You know what I mean? Like, it was part of who we were and what we did. So unfortunately, obviously, like, Latino Rebels is no more, but what remains is the rebellion. And I think that, to be fair to our colleagues, I'm 40 years old and I've been reporting for 3 years. Most people in the building who have been reporting for 3 years are in their mid-20s, right? So it's a lot different when you're trying to push around a 40-year-old that's lived in Washington for 15 years, understands the swamp, understands the power dynamics at play, right? And then joins the press corps. So then it's like, yo, you want to push this guy around? I don't think so. You know what I mean? I've been watching reporters get pushed around for 15 years. When I joined the press corps, I was like, if there's one thing that's never going to happen, it's me getting pushed around, right? So when it comes to these documents, I don't know what other reporters would have done if they would have found these documents, but I don't think they would have been online as quickly as when I found them. I think there would have been a process that was sort of like, okay, let's look at these. Let's reach out to Senator Cruz. Let's see, like, you know, what they have to say and all the rest, which is a typical reporting process. And I'm not saying it's a bad process, but it does give Senator Cruz the opportunity to lie. And he is a liar. Like, he is most of the politicos in the Capitol. They lie all the time to save their skin, right? So I didn't want to give him that opportunity. I knew what I was looking at. I've staffed people. I've written briefing documents. I've written more briefing documents than I can remember. So I knew what I was looking at. And did there exist the possibility that these were like planted by Vladimir Putin or Antifa or something? Sure, right? But at the same time, it was just sort of like, if that happens, Ted Cruz is going to be like, I'm not going to New York. This reporter is an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, that didn't happen because he was going to New York and I did know what I was talking about. So I did take a risk that I think people who work at like the Washington Post or whatever were not going to be willing to take. And that doesn't mean that what they do isn't important or what that they do isn't excellent in their own way. I just think that what I did in that moment was more excellent than anything they possibly could have accomplished within the bureaucracy of their newsroom, which is very focused on a couple of different things, right? Covering their behind and maintaining their prestige. But we're Latino rebels, right? Prestige is not a factor here, right? Like, we're rebels, we're rebellion, we're upstarts, right? So I wasn't focused on what prestige, right? Nobody thinks of us as prestigious. People think of us as aggressive reporting forces of nature, right? So when I put them out there, I was just like in that same Latino spirit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the biggest story I broke at Latino Rebels was about a Black staffer who was mistreated in his office, Senator Feinstein's office, the late Senator Feinstein's office. And the reaction that I got from the establishment press when I posted that story was, well, you know, Senator Feinstein is at her husband's funeral. Like, that's kind of tasteless. Why would you do that? I have no idea what Senator Feinstein is doing in California. Are you serious? A Black staffer told me that he had been abused, and I reported the story. And when I reached out to Senator Feinstein's office, they didn't reply. So he ran with his story and said they didn't reply, you know? And I realized in that moment, the reception that we had from the Black community, from the Latino community, from all of these communities of color that don't feel like the press goes hard enough at the obvious institutional corruptions and bigotries that go on in the first branch of our government, the legislative branch, the first branch, according to our founding fathers, right, of this country, you know, well, we were filling a void. And I felt like with the Ted Cruz documents, too, we're filling a void. You know, the confidence that the American people have in the press, which is such an important institution in our country, I know, having been born under Pinochet, where if you posted Ted Cruz's documents under Pinochet, you might be tortured to death and thrown in the sea, right? Whereas in this country, they can't do anything. I'm going to go home in oil paint, and there's nothing they can do about it. So I felt like in the moment that I was fulfilling the essential mission of what the First Amendment was supposed to be from the beginning when they wrote it, I felt like I was pushing back on the over-professionalization of news where everybody questions themselves to the point that people don't trust us anymore. You know what I mean? Like you trip over yourself so much, and sometimes it's because you want to win an award. Sometimes it's because you don't want to get sued. Sometimes it's because you want to maintain your access or your relationship with Ted Cruz. I don't care about awards. I don't have anything you could sue me for, right? And my relationship with Ted Cruz is fine. You know what I mean? Like, he's not somebody who takes things personally, in my experience with him anyway. And I don't think that this is going to change, right? Plus, I hate to say it, but like, if you're a donor and Ted Cruz is going to you to ask for like $50,000, I would feel like a baller. I'd be like, oh my God, yeah, I'm meeting with a senator tomorrow. I'm a New Yorker. I'm meeting with Ted Cruz tomorrow. Yeah, that's what's up. What are you doing tomorrow? Are you meeting with anybody who's bigger than Ted Cruz? Because I'm meeting with Ted Cruz. That's what I would say. So I didn't feel like I was really doing anyone dirty, except for the one guy, Novogratz, whose home address I posted online. I felt like that was inappropriate. And if I could do it over again, I wouldn't have done it that way. And I won't do it that way the next time Ted Cruz's staffers or any other staffers leave their finance documents around the Capitol for me to find.
So I feel like we could have a whole hour-long conversation, not only to the power dynamics between some reporters who are inexperienced with the lawmakers on Capitol Hill, but also the power dynamics between lawmakers and the donors that are in question in these leaked documents. Let's make it very clear in these leaked documents that it's the donors who are in charge here, not this elected senator from Texas. No, it's the other way around. And yet, that's a whole can of worms and a Pandora's box in and of itself. So, Pablo, as a point of clarity, Yahoo News also mentioned, and I think this is also very important, that Ted Cruz is the top Republican on the Senate Commerce Committee, which, among other things, deals with transportation and telecommunications issues, which is also some of the wheelings and dealings that these donors in New York have a vested interest in. And it's certainly something that iHeartMedia has a vested interest in. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
100%. So I'm told iHeartMedia paid $600,000 to Ted Cruz's PAC as part of his podcast. So Ted Cruz does a podcast and he likes to be cute about it. The podcast is produced by his PAC. And my understanding is that they pay Ted Cruz as a contributor to the podcast. So the Ted Cruz PAC pays Ted Cruz as a contributor to his podcast. Now, iHeartRadio paying $600,000 to the podcast, right? It's really funny because one of the big issues that Ted Cruz has taken up this Congress is to push for AM radio to be automatically and required to be installed in every new car, right? Now, who's going to benefit from that?
iHeartRadio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting that that's the feedback loop. And again, maybe it's plausibly deniable. Maybe Ted Cruz really likes AM radio. Maybe iHeartRadio is just like, yo, we really like Ted Cruz's audience. And with the $600,000 that we put into it today, we're going to make $10 million off of it from all the people that like who listen. But it doesn't look good, right? And Ted Cruz suspiciously has filed for an extension on his personal financial disclosure. So we don't know specifically how much money he's received in income from his podcast or other places. The extension is through August. So in August, a personal financial disclosure form for Ted Cruz should drop. And maybe that'll give us some more clarity on these very specific dollar amounts that he was asking that the briefing document suggested that he asked from these New York donors.
It's interesting that you brought up AM radio because Arturo, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first time I had you on this show, we were talking about hate speech on AM radio, specifically in Florida. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility of what Pablo just mentioned with regards to the absurd idea of having AM radio mandatory in new cars in this day of age, correct?
Right, yeah. You know, it's kind of right in there, in that ballpark. But every time I hear that, making AM radio mandatory, it brings me back to being a kid, right? Like, we had the 8-track player that had the AM radio that you could push the buttons and, you know, it would go to one station or another. That's what it makes me think of. It makes me think of these old Oldsmobile. But yeah, you know, Ted Cruz, there's some issues too with the donations from iHeartRadio and how he gets paid. Like, that's becoming an issue. I know that it's discussed on the local news here probably once a week or so, just because it's kind of murky as to like how that's being done. And like I said earlier, you know, he's always riding that fine line with these finance laws, and he probably knows exactly what he's doing. He's just riding, you know, and everybody has questions about it, and he's not going to answer them. He wants them sidetracked with that and using up resources trying to figure that out. But I'm sure somehow, some way, he's going to get away with it. He always does.
I'm also certain that Marco Rubio over in Florida had his ear with regards to this idea, because he's also been somebody who's been in favor of deregulating FCC rules with regards to media ownership, especially in Florida. What was the name of that radio station? Radio Mambi?
Mambi, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility, considering that both of them have been in favor of deregulating FCC laws with regards to those sort of things. So, Pablo, you know what? Usually towards the end of the show, I would ask the guests, what else do you hope people learn from these leaked documents? But considering what we just mentioned, the normalization of institutional corruption, like what we see here in these documents, I don't know if we could say that people are going to learn anything here, so long as corporate media outlets are the ones that are sort of normalizing this sort of action, like that GOP operative, the anonymous one that was mentioned on Yahoo News. And so this story isn't over yet. Congress will be back next month. Correct me if I'm wrong.
July 8th, the Senate returns, yeah.
July 8th. And some questions should be asked of Ted Cruz's actions at the Capitol. But the truth is that this form of institutional corruption is so normalized in Congress that there's little chance of punishment, I believe, or reprimand, so long as other people on both sides are doing the same thing. So rather than learning a lesson here, what's going to happen next in the coming weeks and months ahead with this?
When he gets back, I want to ask Ted Cruz what his relationship with Len Blavatnik. The other donors are less important, I think, but like Len Blavatnik is really interesting because he's a Ukrainian-born, Russian-educated oligarch who, you know, he's on the Forbes billionaire list. He's worth about $33 billion. So what does Blavatnik want from Cruz, and why is he going through a go-between instead of meeting him directly? And I think to answer your question about the most important lesson that people can learn from these documents, the single most important lesson that the public absolutely needs to internalize is that if they subscribe to Capital.press, they will find out more, you know? Like that to me is the essence of democracy right there. You know, we're like poor Richard, man. Like, so Latino Rebels 2.0, right? So that is an important lesson that the public should learn, you know? So
I had to mute my mic because you gave me a headache from laughing so hard. So let me give the last word to Arturo here. I forgot your name. Arturo, I mean, again, I don't know what else we could learn from here, but what do you see happening in the coming weeks ahead as well? I mean, what else to summarize this whole chain of events? I know that you're in Texas, so to a very large degree, this doesn't surprise you a lot with regards to Ted Cruz, but still, it's out there. It's almost like another chapter to this book of corruption that we could do on Ted Cruz alone.
In the coming weeks, it's going to be crazy because, you know, been tracking like a lot of this Project 2025 and Heritage Foundation, and then there's the Conservative Partnership Institute, which doesn't get as much attention as Heritage, but the Conservative Partnership Institute has a lot of like the same organizations in Heritage that are backing it. They've spent close to $100 million in the last election, in the midterms, you know, on anti-LGBTQ ads, a lot of racist ads, anti-Black ads. There's all kinds of stuff. Ted Cruz is part of the Conservative Partnership Institute. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, they all do podcasts from the headquarters over there.
Really?
So been watching a lot of that. Yeah. If people aren't familiar with Conservative Partnership Institute, I recommend looking them up. They have a big building in D.C. A lot of congressmen and lawmakers have offices there. They call it a home away from home. That's probably where they do a lot of their fundraising. But yeah, it's a pretty big deal. They're tied somewhat to Heritage, but they're way more MAGA than Heritage Foundation is, and that's what's scary about it. So, really? But yeah, be keeping an eye on that, wondering like where this whole Ted Cruz thing fits into that. I'm going to be keeping an eye on that too. So yeah, it's going to be crazy.
Man, and you know what? It's going to be hard to top these leaked documents, or at the very least, break the internet the same way Pablo did.
I know.
But
yeah,
with that said, I'm curious to know what you guys have coming up down the pike on the Substack page, and give us the name one more time so people can check it out and check out some of the other articles that you have on there.
Yeah, so Capital.press, as you've seen on Thursday, we posted Carlos Jimenez, the congressman from Florida, the former mayor of Miami, said that immigrants don't deserve advanced parole, the new Biden executive order. Now, Arturo and I found out that how did Carlos Jimenez's Cuban family come to America? Well, advanced parole. So highlighting the hypocrisies of these lawmakers is sometimes even more satisfying than exposing their inequities of campaign finance. And this is one of those instances. So Capital.press, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe.
And don't forget to subscribe.
Oh, man. You know what? I forgot to mention something earlier that I hope everyone is enjoying this little mini Latino Rebels reunion that we have here of former producers and writers. Because, you know, if it's going to be as fun as this little conversation today, then I should have the both of you on again in the future. But in the meantime, I've been speaking with Pablo Manriquez, who's a contributing editor for The New Republic, and Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Texas. Pablo, it's been fun. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And Arturo, as always, it's fun. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Man, as always, it's a pleasure. Always have fun. This was a really good episode.
Yes, it was. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to your show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Spangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a series of key rulings today. In a politically charged decision, justices raised the standard for prosecutors to charge Capitol riot defendants with obstruction, which is a charge also being faced by former President Trump. The ruling says the charge of obstructing an official proceeding must be brought only if there is proof of a defendant tampering with or destroying documents. That decision means charges could be dropped against some people involved in the 2021 Capitol riot. The court also overturned a 40-year-old decision colloquially known as Chevron that gave federal agencies flexibility to interpret unclear laws passed by Congress. Overturning Chevron has long been a goal of conservative judicial activists, and the court's liberal justices dissented. A Biden administration lawyer said the ruling would be a, quote, unwarranted shock to the legal system. And the court also ruled in favor of cities attempting to enforce bans on homeless people sleeping outdoors, overturning a San Francisco appeals court decision that found outdoor sleeping bans amount to cruel and unusual punishment. The 6-3 decision, along ideological lines, comes as homelessness is rising in the United States, and as many cities, particularly on the West Coast, struggle to provide enough shelter space. President Biden and former President Trump faced off on the debate stage last night, and Democratic strategists and former elected officials are voicing concern over Biden's performance, which was marked by stumbles, pauses, and confusing statements. Several media outlets are quoting officials as questioning whether Biden is a strong candidate and could be replaced on the ballot. Debates aren't necessarily make-or-break moments for candidates, but age and mental acuity have become top issues in an election pitting an 81-year-old against a 78-year-old. Top Biden supporters, including Vice President Harris and California Governor Gavin Newsom, sought to downplay the importance of Biden's debate gaffes and pushed back on the many false statements Trump made last night. Some Democratic strategists suggested Biden could be replaced on the ballot, an outcome that would be highly unlikely without the president's support. The former school's police chief in Uvalde, Texas, was indicted yesterday for the slow police response to a 2022 elementary school massacre that killed 19 children and two teachers. Former Chief Pete Arredondo was indicted on 10 counts of felony child endangerment or abandonment and booked into county jail before being released on bond. Former school cop Adrian Gonzalez was also indicted. The two former cops are the first to face criminal charges in one of the country's deadliest school shootings. Hundreds of police waited for more than 70 minutes to confront the 18-year-old shooter, even as he could be heard firing an AR-15-style rifle inside the school. Iowa's Supreme Court today upheld that state's strict abortion law, instructing a lower court to lift a temporary pause on the law. The law bans most abortions after only about 6 weeks of pregnancy, before many women know they are pregnant. The 4-3 ruling means Iowa joins over a dozen other states with restrictive abortion laws, following the overturning of federal abortion rights in 2022. The court's chief justice dissented, writing that the ruling, quote, strips Iowa women of their bodily autonomy, end quote. And in international news, Bolivia weathered an attempted coup 2 days ago, in which armored vehicles rammed the government palace, and a top general said armed forces were attempting to, quote, restore democracy and free our political prisoners. But soldiers pulled back from the palace after Bolivian President Luis Arce ordered their withdrawal and removed the general from his post. Arce named new heads of the military branches and held a rally with supporters in the capital, La Paz. National elections will be held in Bolivia next year.